If there was one topic where the antiquary John Aubrey and his friend and protector, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, were absolutely of one mind, it was of the disagreeableness of John Wallace. Although trained as a theologian, Wallace had been appointed civilian professor of geometry in the University of Oxford in 1649, mainly on account of, of his services to Parliament as a decipherer during the Civil Wars. As someone whose career had profited decisively from the English Revolution, he was despised by those who, at least outwardly, had remained loyal to the old order. Since his arrival in Oxford, he had realised the promise he had shown through his deciphering skills and had made an important contribution to the rapidly growing field of what would later become called mathematical analysis. Moreover, he was now highly respected in the Republic of Letters and corresponded regularly with men such as Johannes Hevelius, Christian Huygens, and René-François de Sluys. But for Hobbes and Aubrey, he was a scientific parvenu who needed to be cut down to size. After Wallace had clearly placed himself on the side of Hevelius in his controversy with Robert Hooke over the merits of telescopic sights in positional astronomy, Aubrey delighted in attacking his lowly social status and his supposed inclination to make use of the intellectual property of others. In his letter to Hobbes of the 24th of June 1675, he portrays his friend Hooke as a victim of Wallace's dishonourable character. Okay. He. He has been made. He has been as much abused by Dr. Wallace as anyone. He makes it his trade to be a common spy, steals from every ingenious person's discourse, and prints it, namely from Sir Christopher Wren, God knows how often, from Mr. Hooke, etc. He is a most ill-natured man, an egregious liar and a backbiter, a flatterer and a fawner on my Lord Brouncker and his miss, that my Lord may keep up his reputation. Of all Wallace's purported traits of character, which men like Aubrey, Hobbes and Anthony Wood have handed down to us through their chronicles, letters, biographies and other writings, that of intellectual dishonesty has clung to him most harmfully. In part, this is because many of the episodes which historically have appeared to lend weight to claims of dishonesty have not been thoroughly analysed using all the available resources. In part, it is because Wallace often overused his renowned rhetorical skills whenever he felt he had been wronged, and ultimately did himself more harm than good when, as so often, controversies with contemporaries arose. To a large part, this is also due to the lack, up to this day, of an intellectual biography devoted to his life and work. Too many of his multifaceted activities, of the details of his role and reputation within the Republic of Letters, still remain unknown. John Wallace's account of his life, written for his friend Thomas Smith in 1697, is one of the most revealing documents on early 17th century university education in England. Occasionally, it is also revealing about Wallace himself. While conducting his undergraduate studies at Emmanuel College, Cambridge, we learn that unimpressed by the curriculum, he had happily diverted to other topics such as astronomy, geography, natural philosophy, and what he calls other parts of mathematics. But his strongest interest was apparently gained in the field of theoretical anatomy and physiology, claiming to have been the first pupil of Francis Glisson, Regius Professor of Physic, to have disputed publicly in favour of Harvey's theory of the circulation of the blood. Clearly, even allowing for the distance in time between the experience and the recollection, this was a young man intent on making his mark in the new philosophy. But it almost went terribly wrong. Okay. Unable to gain a fellowship at Emmanuel or elsewhere, Wallace followed the path of many young contemporaries into personal chaplaincy, serving first Sir Richard Darley at Buttercram in Yorkshire, and then Mary, Lady Vere, at her residences Castle Headingham in Essex and Clapton near Hackney in London. This was probably the only time in his long life that Wallace would enjoy the benefits of patronage, a topic which Lisa Smith discussed in detail in connection with the Sloane correspondence last week. Lady Vere was renowned as a patron of Puritan ministers, first in the Netherlands, where her husband, Horace Vere, was in service to the Dutch Republic, and after his death in 1635, back in England, she had employed and given support to many a godly preacher of both Calvinist and Presbyterian persuasion. By the 1640s, Lady Vere had also developed close links to the parliamentary opposition to the crown, not least through the marriage of her fourth daughter, Anne, to the army commander, Thomas Fairfax. Both of these connections would prove fortuitous for Wallace's future career. First, it was through meeting a chaplain of the army commander, Sir William Waller, at supper in Lady Vere's London residence one night in January 1643, that Wallace famously discovered his ability to decipher encoded texts. Once the true extent of this ability became apparent, Parliament readily drew on his expertise in the course of its military and, above all, political campaigns. There can be no doubt that it was principally on account of his actual or promised services as a decipherer that Wallace, in the spring of 1649, was given a civilian chair at Oxford. He had the choice of either the geometry or the astronomy professorship. Lucky man. Indeed, the governing party was even prepared to overlook his vehement opposition to the trial and execution of Charles I. Second, it was undoubtedly through the support of Lady Vere that Wallace, at the end of his period of personal chaplaincy, was appointed by the House of Commons to the influential Westminster Assembly of Divines. The appointment was made upon a representation of the Westminster Assembly itself and involved him in assisting the scribes Adoniram Byfield and Henry Roeborough. Like Wallace, Byfield had studied at Emmanuel College, Cambridge, and Roeborough would eventually join Wallace in his opposition to the regicide. But more pertinently, there were long-standing and close ties between the Byfield family and the Veres. The Westminster Assembly provided ideal conditions for preferment for the young, moderate Presbyterian John Wallace. In the spring of 1644, he was one of nine men appointed fellows of Queen's College, Cambridge, by the parliamentarian and army officer Edward Montagu, 2nd Earl of Manchester, who had been charged with regulating the university. Appointed alongside him was the Platonist and mathematician John Smith, who had likewise studied at Emmanuel. The nomination came from Herbert Palmer, who was tasked by the Westminster Assembly with drafting its shorter catechism. After his death in 1647, he was succeeded as Master of Queen's by Thomas Horton, one of Wallace's former tutors at Emmanuel, while Wallace himself published a brief and easy explanation of the shorter catechism according to the principles laid down by and developed by Palmer. Barely grasped, the academic career soon drifted again into the realm of mere possibility. After his marriage to Susanna Glyde, a year later, Wallace had to resign his fellowship, but soon thereafter, in the spring of 1645, he was presented with a sequestrated living of St. Gabriel in Fenchurch Street, London. Following his appointment by the House of Commons as trier in the ninth classes in April 1647, Wallace was then made minister at St. Martin's, Ironmonger Lane. I'll go to the next. To anyone considering his position at the time, it must have seemed that Wallace was now destined for an uneventful career in church ministry, for his importance as a decipherer would not have been publicly known, and in any case probably did not reach its peak until its first peak until 1650-51. But to have thought this would have meant not taking into account the importance of Wallace's geographical location. I'm going to try the pointer now. So this is the City of London. A couple of markers. This is Gresham College, 36. We have Fenchurch Street here. We have Cheapside here. We have Wood Street here. And Ironmonger Lane is a parallel road or street to Wood Street along there. So it's all in very close proximity. At the beginning of November 1648, Wallace received a letter from his former colleague at Queen's, John Smith, who had encountered problems while working through Book 3 of Descartes' Geometry. This is our first encounter with Wallace as a practicing mathematician, although we know that his interest was awakened already during his school days. The young London minister, who had evidently largely taught himself the rudiments of algebra by working through William Oughtred's Clavis Mathematicae, not only succeeded in solving Smith's problems during a series of epistolary exchanges in November and December of that year, but also happened upon rules for reducing cubic equations, two of which he subsequently found to correspond to those of Girolamo Cardano, which Girolamo Cardano had first published in his Ars Magna of 1545. In fact, Wallace established this equivalence when, early in 1649, he was able to borrow a copy from a friend in London, possibly Charles Scarborough, who shared his interest in algebra, a copy of Franz van Schooten's first Latin edition of the Geometrie. There he found, as he writes many years later to the intelligentsia John Collins, I quote, "My two first rules for cubic equations, to be cited by him as Cardan's rules, without any demonstration or reason of them given." The absence of any demonstration had evidently been the grounds for Smith's original inquiry. This discovery led Wallace to his next decisive move. Early in 1649, he put pen to paper and wrote to Franz van Schooten himself, an action made all the more understandable when we consider that van Schooten had supplemented his translation of the Geometrie with a massive commentary, not to mention the inclusion of Florimond de Beaune's brief notes. Unfortunately, Wallace's letter to van Schooten has not survived, but this does not diminish its importance. The letter initiated a correspondence not only with van Schooten himself, but also with his brilliant student Christian Huygens, who, although still taking private tuition with van Schooten, already finds mention in the 1649 edition of the Geometrie. Up to van Schooten's death in 1660, news of Wallace's letters and publications was regularly conveyed between the two men. Although Wallace's primary motive for writing to van Schooten would have been to address the author of the Latin edition of Descartes' work, there can be little doubt that he had other reasons extending far beyond the singularity of authorship. From the text of his inaugural lecture given at the in the University of Oxford on the 31st of October 1649, some 6 months after his appointment as civilian professor of geometry, we see that already at this time he was particularly interested in the broader scope of algebra as an ars inveniendi, speaking on that occasion of many theorems lately discovered in mathematics, whose discovery was greatly facilitated by the mode of discovery itself, I quote, that is to say, algebra or analytical practices beyond those known to the ancients now becoming known. Intimately connected with the importance he accorded to algebra was his programmatic aim to elevate arithmetic to the status of universal mathematics by contending that results in geometry can be achieved more evidently and naturally by the use of arithmetical arguments. Moreover, he claimed that geometry took its principles from arithmetic because the principles are presupposed in any geometrical demonstration. When he briefly introduces modern algebra or analytics in his 1651 Oxford Lectures on Euclid, Wallace not only contrasts it with classical algebra, but also emphasizes its usefulness. Later, in the spirit of the arithmetization of algebra, he would terminologically replace Fayette's concept of spacious logistics with his own concept of spacious arithmetic, arithmetica speciosa, which he nevertheless ascribes to the French mathematician. What better way to promote his universal mathematics in general and his arithmetica speciosa in particular than through entering into dialogue with other capable minds, even if, or perhaps because, they were of Cartesian persuasion, as in the case of van Schooten and Huygens. This is to say that there were evident programmatic reasons for Wallace to write to van Schooten in 1649. Moreover, he makes clear right at the start of his long tenure of the civilian chair in geometry how much value he places on open communication of mathematical knowledge, contrasting the closed nature of the Greek polis with the possibilities for dissemination of knowledge afforded through the printing of books. Indeed, this is the second deeper level to the contrast he often draws between the arithmetica speciosa, or true art of discovery, which he develops from the early 1650s onwards, and the method of investigation, I quote, which the ancients were wont, as great secrets, to conceal from us. Shortly after writing to Van Schooten, Wallace initiated another correspondence with a leading exponent of mathematical science beyond England's borders. This time it is a move which provides us with a much clearer evidence of his conscious effort to establish links to the Republic of Letters, spanning European science, and which also reflects more evidently the geographical and intellectual environment in which he found himself at the time, which I referred to in respect of the London map. As we know from the account of his life which he wrote for Smith, Wallace became associated with a group of like-minded men in London around 1645. This so-called 1645 group met regularly to discuss topics of philosophical inquiry in a variety of fields. Wallace mentions explicitly physic, anatomy, geometry, astronomy, navigation, statics, magnetics, chemics, mechanics, and natural experiments. Of the seven men he names, besides himself, four were medical practitioners, including Jonathan Goddard and Francis Glisson, whom Wallace knew well from his Cambridge days. The intelligence and translator, Theodore Hark, who, as Wallace recalls, first suggested the institution of regular meetings, had in the past corresponded regularly with Marin Mersenne, giving him details of scientific developments and publications in England, and he was now engaged by the Westminster Assembly to translate the annotations to the Dutch Bible. Hark himself from the Palatinate would almost certainly have met John Wilkins, then chaplain to the Prince Elector Palatine, in Carl Ludwig's circle in London. The oldest member alongside Glisson was Samuel Forster, professor of astronomy at Gresham College, where the group would generally gather during term time. But particularly when experiments were to be performed, they would meet instead in Goddard's lodgings in Wood Street on account of his keeping an operator in his house for grinding glasses for telescopes and microscopes. That's a quotation from Wallace's Pro Vita Sua. At other times, they would meet at the Bull Tavern in Cheapside. So we can see that all these locations are in immediate vicinity of each other. It is probable that Hark's well-known report to Mersenne, dated April 1648, of experiments carried out in London on the vacuum and on the descent of heavy bodies, was based on one of the meetings of this group of men. Possibly after his interest was awakened while attending one of these meetings, Wallace was lent a copy of another recent publication from abroad. As in the case of Van Schooten's Geometria a Renato Descartes, he was persuaded after reading intently its weighty content, after inspecting the intricate diagrams, to take out pen and paper and write to its author. The book was Selenographia, the first detailed description of the surface of the moon, and its author was Johannes Hevelius. Wallace's introductory letter to Hevelius, written on the 3rd of April 1649, is remarkable in a number of ways. Right at the beginning, he establishes his credentials for addressing him by citing the names of two people in his own circle of acquaintances in London who were equally well known to the Danzig astronomer. I quote, "I saw not long ago, by means of the help of Mr. Hartlib, your outstanding work on selenography, and I have examined it with eager eyes. Then, partly excited by the thesis of the book itself, which is absolutely new, partly by the praises of Dr. Goddard, an exceptional physician, and others, no small hope was awakened in me, nor did the eager expectation deceive me." The reference to Goddard places the letter firmly in the context of the 1645 group. As we know from Hevelius' correspondence with Hartlib, Goddard had offered to send a telescope to Hevelius in October 1647, presumably one produced by the instrument maker living in his house. As one prepared to engage in scientific exchange and collaboration, Goddard is favourably mentioned in epistolary exchanges between Comenius and Hartlib, and in December 1647 he was given a copy of the Selenographia by Hartlib at Hevelius' request. Wallace not only praises Hevelius' work as a contribution to mathematical studies, but also, importantly, presents himself as someone willing to collaborate with him, specifically through providing help with the calculation of longitudes and setting these out in appropriate tabular form. In this context, he remarks that Hevelius' great project, I quote, would certainly be much lightened by the hands of many. Nor was this offer of assistance overly presumptuous, for Hevelius had himself noted in numerous places in the Selenographia the usefulness of combining the observations of other astronomers as a means to achieving a common task more commodiously. We are reminded here of Robert Hatch's talk at the beginning of the series, where he emphasised the importance of astronomy in generating the culture of collaborative correspondence. And of course, Hatch had undertaken a lot of investigations, particularly into Bulio and to Hevelius during his time in Paris. Wallace's offer of assistance was, therefore, fully in accord with sentiments expressed in the book, but more importantly, was designed to portray himself as one worthy of belonging to Hevelius's circle of correspondence. He even goes so far as to say that he would, of course, uphold the same standards of rigour as those employed by Hevelius. But perhaps Wallace's closing words are the most remarkable of all, for he makes an honest statement of his circumstances which only serves to emphasise what he would rather be doing. I will not be unwilling to share my own work, namely insofar as theological matters with which I earn my living allow. Wallace's proposal in the spirit of scientific collaboration could not fail to impress its addressee far away on the Baltic coast. Hevelius soon replied, thanking his new correspondent for his generous offer, but pointing out that he had found it necessary to delay somewhat continuing with work on the Selenography project. His gratitude was soon expressed more concretely through a copy of the Selenographia, which Hevelius asked Hartlib to give to Wallace. It seems that Hartlib had a whole stack of copies of this very expensive book. A pattern of intellectual commerce to mutual benefit was thus established. Moreover, the possibilities of this commerce soon improved dramatically through the beginning of Wallace's academic career. When he next wrote to Hevelius, Wallace not only thanked him for the copy of the extremely valuable book he had received, but also announced his recent appointment as civilian professor of geometry in Oxford. Wallace's epistolary exchanges with Hevelius exemplify the ideals of intellectual and scientific collaboration which Oldenburg articulated on numerous occasions when initiating his own networks of correspondence in the early 1660s after being installed in the office of second secretary to the Royal Society. It was probably not necessary for Oldenburg, in his first letter to Hevelius, dated 18th of February 1663, to emphasise quite so much as he did the importance of friendship among learned men as a means to promoting the investigation and elucidation of the truth. For Hevelius was already convinced of this himself, as his extensive correspondence with members of the circles around Mersenne and Hartlib testify to us today. But even if Oldenburg's words were in the spirit of intellectual commerce, to which he also subscribed, it nonetheless made perfect sense for the Danzig astronomer to see just how far the Royal Society's willingness for collaboration went. In his reply to Oldenburg, he suggested that work on his next great project, the Machina Coelestis, would be greatly aided by a careful transcription and Latin translation of a Persian manuscript of Ulugh Beg's Catalogue of the Fixed Stars held in the Bodleian Library. Hevelius points out that he has already written to Wallace that he might satisfy this wish. However, he also had another pressing concern, for which reason he sent the letter with Johannes Koopman, a relative of his wife, Elizabeth, who helped him often in his astronomical observations. And this other pressing concern was, quite clearly, to recover a not inconsiderable debt owed to him by the heirs of the estate of Samuel Hartlib. As Lee Penman suggested in his talk 2 weeks ago, Hartlib's debts might well have had something to do with the fate of his papers. Just as Wallace fulfilled Hevelius's wish for a transcription of Ulugh Beg's and later also Ptolemy's catalogue of the fixed stars, in both cases based on manuscripts from the Bodleian collections, so too did the civilian professor regularly receive copies of Hevelius's expensively produced astronomical works, and we'll see another example of this later on. Their correspondence was an excellent example of the pattern of Doet Des, which Nora Gedeker identified in many of Leibniz's correspondences earlier in this seminar series. From a present-day point of view, it is hard to imagine just how far scientific discussion in the second half of the 17th century was shaped by rivalries, methodological disputes, and accusations of plagiarism. This reality stands in sharp contrast to the calls for collaboration in promoting the new mathematical and physical sciences, which came out of the tradition of Comenius and Hartlib, and which, through Oldenburg and to a lesser extent Robert Moray, characterised the early history of the Royal Society. Wallace's correspondence with Van Schooten and Huygens is illustrative of the culture of competition and dispute which were equally part of the Republic of Letters, alongside discussions on recent discoveries and latest publications. As Mordecai Feingold has recently emphasized, the Republic of Letters was anything but a gentleman's club. Principles of discourse and scientific practice could often conflate among men working in similar fields, where questions of publicly perceived success and status were inextricably linked. Wallace's call for openness, uttered first in his Oratio Inauguralis of 1649, was repeated many times throughout his career, most memorably in his letter to Isaac Newton of the 30th of April 1695. I quote, "If men will never publish out, or ought, till it be so perfect as that nothing more can be added to it, themselves and the public will both be losers." With this principle in mind, he was understandably not amused when Huygens, in June 1655, concluded a discussion of his work on the quadrature of the ellipse and the hyperbola with mention of a recent astronomical discovery hidden in a cipher. So we have a letter from Huygens to Wallace talking about his recent work, and then towards the end comes the cipher, which he very enticingly mentioned, "This is a great astronomical discovery I've made," but of course he doesn't reveal it. Wallace replied almost petulantly with an astronomical cipher of his own. However, in many ways, Huygens' disinclination to publish too soon would soon prove to have been a sound decision. For in subsequent observations made with his elder brother Constantine, he was able to establish that what he had seen was in fact a ring round Saturn. The original cipher contained the message that he had found a moon to be orbiting Saturn. It was only then, when more careful observations were made, that it was found to be a ring. And when he made these more careful observations with his brother, as I say, his older brother, he published them under the title of Systema Saturnium in 1659. So in a way he was vindicated. Other entanglements between Huygens and the civilian professor were more weighty, and Wallace was not always able to live up to the high principles he espoused. In 1659, Van Schooten published his second edition of Descartes' Geometrie, including as an appendix a 1659 letter from Hendrik van Heuraet, in which the young Dutch mathematician presented his rectification of the semicubical parabola by means of the transformation of the curve into straight lines. Since no one had put anything comparable into print, Heuraet could apparently claim with some justification to have provided the first genuinely public proof of the rectification of an algebraic curve. Wallace, however, felt that this honour should go instead to William Neale, son of the courtier Sir Paul Neale, since the young English mathematician had given a proof of his rectification at one of the regular meetings of the scientifically interested men at Gresham College in July and August 1657. These London meetings were, of course, the immediate forerunners of the Royal Society. For the civilian professor, the appearance of a printed text was not decisive as a criterion of publication, and accordingly he applied his rhetorical skills in rejecting Heuraet's claim. It is not necessary here to rehearse the various stages of this dispute, which lasted on and off for 14 years, reaching its culmination in the reassertion of the Dutch claim by Huygens in his Horologium Oscillatorium of 1673. Wallace could not hide his disappointment at what Huygens had written, believing that he had provided him with conclusive evidence against the priority of Heuraet's rectification. In a series of letters to Oldenburg, in which he claims he inserted an honest and fair history of all that had passed in his communications with Huygens, he sets out again his reasons for denying priority to Heuraet. On the last occasion, his letter of 4th of October 1673, written in Latin and thus intended for his audience across the English Channel, Wallace emphasizes that despite the forceful words used by him and indeed Huygens in the course of their dispute, the scholarly conventions of the Republic of Letters had not been broken. I quote, "But I am fearful of seeming to look too deeply into that question. I do not wish, however, that you should attribute what had been said to any animosity against Heuraet, of whom I know neither good nor ill, nor against Huygens, whom I have always held and shall hold in the greatest respect, and to whom I have always behaved in the friendliest manner," that's the key word, "in the friendliest manner, having been no unkind judge both of him and his discoveries, nor yet against Fermat, one of the best of men, but rather in order to witness to the plain truth and to Neale, who is dead now, and to all those of our nation who, long before Heuraet, demonstrated that very same thing, and also that I might not appear to have been untrustworthy in the account of this affair which I have formerly published." End of quotation. The question of the conventions of scholarly discourse reappears crucially in Wallace's later correspondence with Hevelius in the context of his dispute with Hooke, to which the passage quoted at the beginning of this talk referred. Like Wallace's dispute with Huygens over the respective claims of Neale and Heuraet, Hooke's dispute with Hevelius over the latter's use of open-sided instruments, as opposed to telescopic lenses, was of long duration, having originated in the early 1660s. It is not necessary here to give an account of this dispute, for it has been made the topic of a number of recent investigations. From the outset, Wallace defended Hevelius's right to use the instruments of his choice. When John Flamsteed, the Astronomer Royal, questioned this choice, Wallace replied prosaically, "Only as you think well of your way, so doth he continue to do of his, and you must allow each other to follow the way himself thinks best." Edmund Halley famously sought to resolve the dispute between two esteemed members of the Royal Society by visiting Hevelius in Danzig in 1679. But the acrimony reached new heights in 1685, when Hevelius published his Annus Climactericus, or Critical Year, the title referring to the large-scale destruction of his observatory, instruments and books by fire in 1679. In fact, his, his observatory had been set on fire by a former assistant of his, who was really quite jealous of what Hevelius himself had achieved. The book contained in its preface an account of the dispute with Hooke from Hevelius's perspective, but there is much more besides. This account was supplemented by the inclusion of the text of 27 letters, including one from Wallace, charting the path which the dispute had followed, and crucially also including the opinions on the relative positions of the two adversaries. Taken in sum, they effectively showed that Hevelius's claim that he could achieve the degree of accuracy he desired by means of his instruments was justified, and that Hooke's arguments, not sufficiently backed up by practice, were unreasonable. But more to the point, his personal attacks on Hevelius were deemed to be outside the bounds of scholarly discourse. The strategy of providing a factual, in this sense, historical documentation of a dispute by means of the correspondence through which it had been largely conducted was well known to Wallace. He had, after all, used it to document the dispute on number theoretical problems he had conducted with William Brouncke against Fermat and Fréneckle, with Franz van Schooten more or less as a third party, in his Commercium Epistolicum of 1658. He would later use it spectacularly as a means of documenting the discovery of the calculus from an English perspective in the third volume of his monumental Opera Mathematica, published in Oxford in 1699. For Hevelius, the 27 letters set out as evidence before a tribunal were a clear vindication of his position. And just like to slot in here mention of the fact that if we seek to understand the nature of this presentation, which is, let's say, putting the evidence before the readers as data with which they are then to interpret what has taken place, this is a form of historical account which is being investigated at the moment by a colleague of ours in the history faculty, Pierre Landgren, with very interesting results. Consistently, Wallace was not to come down on chose not to come down on the side of either Hooke or Hevelius on the technical question itself, but in a massive 21-page review of Annus Climactericus in the Philosophical Transactions, he repudiated Hooke on account of his fierce attack on Hevelius, particularly in his earlier animadversions on the first part of Hevelius' Machina Coelestis of 1674. And of course it did not help that Hooke had there included a letter from Wallace, but without asking him beforehand. For Wallace, Hooke had broken the unwritten conventions of the Republic of Letters by launching a personal attack on Hevelius. Hooke, he claimed, had sought, I quote, to raise his own reputation by disparaging what is done by others in things wherein he himself doth nothing. In his review, Wallace takes the reader through each of the 27 letters in turn, employing the words of their authors to express his own condemnation of Hooke's actions, while emphasizing the almost selfless character of Hevelius's contributions to learning. When quoting from Hevelius's letter to Oldenburg of 21st of August 1675, Wallace adds for good measure in parentheses the description of the Danzig astronomer as, and I shall quote here, as one who, without stipend or public salary, without being hired or maintained to that purpose at the charge of others, without any duty or obligation upon thereunto, other than his own inclination to these studies and his willingness to serve the public, hath at his own charges, with the expense of such much time and labour, done what he was able and with good intention and so much more than Mr. Hook either has done or is ever like to do. By the way, this is here a dedication in this insert here on the copy of the Annus Climactericus, which Hevelius sent to Wallace. Wallace not only sets out the relative merits of Hook and Hevelius as he sees them, with a calculated play, of course, on Hook's expense as a paid employee of the Royal Society, but also expresses his own scholarly ideals originating from his time as a minister in London. Nor does Hevelius provide the only example for a remarkable degree of continuity between the beginnings of Wallace's correspondence networks in the late 1640s and his epistolary interactions with the scholarly community towards the end of the century 40 years later. When the Altdorf astronomer and mathematician Johann Christian Sturm sent Wallace a presentation copy of the recently published second part of his Collegium Experimentale Curiosorum in September 1685, it came through the hands of Theodore Hark in London, who in effect had taken over the role played by Hartlib and Oldenburg earlier on. At Wallace's request, Sturm sent him the following year the first part of the work, which had been published already in 1676. This again came via Hark, while the accompanying letter was brought to Wallace in Oxford personally by the poet, the Altdorf poet, Christoph Wegleiter. In his reply, thanking Sturm for his most recent gift, Wallace describes Hark as a most dear friend and as a man who by nature is a promoter of good scholarship. He is rather more explicit on Hark's earlier role in the scientific community in London in the late 1640s, describing him also as the man who, to say no more of him, was the first founder, who, so to speak, placed the first stone of our Royal Society, as it is now called. It is as if the character of Sturm's letter and the way in which it was conveyed to him through the hands of Hark reminded Wallace at a very deep level of the intellectual commerce at the very beginnings of his scientific endeavours. This surely is what prompts him to reflect again on Hark's role in establishing the regular philosophical meetings 40 years earlier. In this paper, I have focused on two of the over 246 correspondences which Wallace conducted during his long academic career at Oxford, stretching from the heady days of the Revolution of 1649 through to the rather more sedate reign of Queen Anne in 1703. I have done this because of the light which these two correspondences shed on his motives for entering into scholarly exchanges in the first place, the importance of the culture of communication and exchange which pervaded the activities of the 1645 group, represented principally through Samuel Hartlib and his friend Theodore Hark. When Wallace took up his appointment in Oxford in 1649, soon to be followed by Seth Ward as astronomy professor, he did not so much bring the mathematical sciences to the university as was suggested not so long ago, well, perhaps 20, 30 years ago by Christopher Hill. He did not so much bring the mathematical sciences to the university, but rather a culture of knowledge in which the mathematical sciences were able to flourish during the following years. This is also true of Ward, who was already in correspondence with Bouillieu, Hevelius, and Mercator before he came to Oxford. Some of Wallace's correspondences developed along the lines of his exchanges with Hevelius. One thinks here principally or particularly of Borelli, Sluys and Viviani. In many ways, his extensive correspondence with Collins and Oldenburg, who mediated most of his overseas exchanges up to 1677, falls into the same category of duetes mentioned earlier. Some of the correspondences developed more along the lines of his exchanges with Huygens. Informative, yes, but also more contentious. One thinks here of his discussions with Chaldry and Hearn on tides, his later discussions with Leibniz. Wallace's dialogue with leading French mathematicians was spectacularly unsuccessful, but the reasons for this lack of success have a lot to do with the nature of the Parisian mathematical community around Roberval and Pascal, and have often been misunderstood. Wallace certainly conducted productive exchanges with men outside that community, including the Jesuit mathematicians Liotot and Berthet. The respect he expressed for Fermat was without doubt also genuine. In the absence of direct patronage, correspondence provided Wallace with the possibility, alongside his published books and articles, to establish his name in the Republic of Letters. When Wallace sat for his famous portrait by Kneller in 1699, a present from his friend Samuel Pepys to the University of Oxford, he chose his backdrop with care. On the table one finds a copy of his last great mathematical work, The Treatise of Algebra, 1685, Latin 1693, and the gold chain awarded to him by Frederick III, the Elector of Brandenburg, and future Frederick I of Prussia, King of Prussia, for his services in deciphering encoded letters. But placed above all else is an opened letter, symbolizing not only the importance of his scholarly activity, but also that it had been the very key to his academic and social status at the university. There we are. Thank you.